Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world.
Hello, and welcome to the Daily Briefing. Today is Thursday, July 28th. I'm Ann Gordon, in for Amanda Borchel-Dunn. I'm here today with political and legal correspondent Carrie Keller-Lynn and military correspondent Emmanuel Fabian. Hello to you both.
Hi, Ann.
Hi, Ann.
Laser Berman, our diplomatic correspondent, will also be updating us from the ground in Ukraine. We'll hear about the latest reshuffling of political parties as the players gear up for the November elections. And we'll hear about the latest activities of Hamas. The word from Kharkiv, Ukraine, is a little unsettling, close to the front lines. And we'll get the good word on Uman, a Rosh Hashanah destination for many ultra-Orthodox men, though not only ultra-Orthodox and not only men. Carrie, let's start with you. I want to especially thank you for being here today, as I know you've somewhat lost your voice. I would like to hear what you have to say about the new Zionist Spirit Party. Is this a rebranding of Yamina, or is it something new?
I think that's a question that everyone is waiting to figure out. So Zionist Spirit, which launched yesterday, is a sort of rebrand, relaunch, and unification of two beleaguered right-wing parties. Yamina, which was former Prime Minister Bennett's party, now being led by Yael Shaked, and a party called Derech Eretz, which you might not be familiar with because it was folded into New Hope in the last elections. Both of them found themselves looking at these November elections without much of a home or a base. And they're coming into these elections with problems. Yamina shrunk its 7 mandates to about a polled 2. And Derech Eretz was pushed out of the merger between New Hope and Blue and White. So these parties really needed each other to find a way to fight their way into the Knesset. That being said, what are they actually presenting? So there's what they're saying they're presenting, and that's what they might actually present for elections, should they pass. What they're presenting is the sort of creative solution to the yes or no to Benjamin Netanyahu question that has plagued Israeli politics over the last 4 and now 5 upcoming cycles of elections. This question of whether or not the longtime Likud leader should continue to be Israel's longest-serving prime minister. Whereas they joined forces in this eclectic coalition to say no last time, they're actually coming out and saying, you know what? We want a broad national Zionist coalition, a unity coalition that includes both Likud and center-left parties, which is kind of a way to split the cake. And why are they doing this? Because they realize that their voters, their potential voters, because they need to fight for voters, they don't currently have voters, are these kind of right-wing, soft-right, largely national religious, but more liberally religious people who really split down the middle as to whether or not they want Netanyahu to come back as prime minister. And so this way, they're kind of splitting the difference, and they're hoping to position themselves as a party that potentially can be kingmaker. If it comes to a scenario in which we have a right bloc that does not cross the 61-seat key number in order to form a government, and they succeed in passing the threshold and getting 4, possibly 5 seats, they could play a really decisive role in determining Israel's political future as to whether or not we go to 6 elections. And I should say that small parties do end up playing these decisive roles. They really can find themselves having outsized influence if they succeed in reattracting voters with these messages and passing the electoral threshold.
Are they going to pass the threshold? Each of these parties would not have passed the threshold on their own.
According to today's polls, and I'll say that Israel's polls are really notoriously unreliable, but incredibly politically influential, both among voters and politicians who make decisions based upon them. But we're also about, 90-something days out from elections. So anything can happen. This is a wide-open game. They hadn't even presented what their party was called until yesterday. So now they're really going to have to do that hard work of reattracting voters, and anything can happen.
Where is Naftali Bennett in all of this? He hailed from Yamina, of course, though several of the Yamina MKs kind of bailed on him in the last few months of the recent government. Is he involved? Is he showing face? What's going on?
So Bennett retired from politics, and maybe retired is a strong word. He said he's taking a break from politics. He's not running for the next Knesset. And he handed over the reins to Shaked about a month ago. So he's kind of out of this game. He's currently alternative prime minister. He's been on vacation recently. He's kind of taking a bit of an involved backseat. And so this will really be Shaked's show. Shaked and Yoaz Hendel.
It'll be really interesting to see how it develops. Next, turning to you, Laser, you have a piece on the site about how refugees settled into the Sabbath observant hotels in Uman. I know there have been cautions issued about whether Hasidim can be guaranteed protection there and whether they should go at all. But in the event that they do, are those refugees really going to need to leave to make room for them?
Well, it certainly is a complex situation shaping up in Uman. On the one hand, you have these refugees who have been sheltered by the Jewish community in these kosher hotels in the Jewish area of Uman. And on the other hand, we have these pilgrims, these very pious pilgrims who are making the journey at some personal risk, at significant financial cost. And they're obviously going to be paying for rooms in those hotels. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm blaming the pilgrims, the worshipers at all, right? I'm sure they're not even aware that they're refugees there. They're simply doing what they do every year. They're paying for rooms. The owners of these hotels make their money 2 weeks a year by hosting these pilgrims. Obviously, fewer Jews are going to come this year. Both Israel and Ukraine are trying to discourage this, but there have been no final decisions made and there's been no official ban on the pilgrimage. The situation that I found is as such. Many refugees, I'm talking about non-Jewish refugees as well as Jewish refugees, but primarily non-Jewish, have been driving through Uman because of its geographical location. So if you're fleeing Donbas, if you're fleeing cities like Mykolaiv, Kherson, those cities in the south and the southeast that have been either under Russian occupation or under Russian attack, Uman is a logical place to drive through. It's centrally located. There's roads that lead there. It's a good place to stop. And when many of these people have been stopping, they've kind of asked around, are there any organizations, where can I sleep? And people have been telling them, or they just found that there are these empty hotels and there are people who are telling them, yeah, come on in, we'll feed you, we'll give you shelter. And this project is run by Rabbi Liron Ederi, who is the rabbi of the city where the Zelenskys come from, Kryvyi Rih. And he realized that he just has, thousands of refugees coming through the city. The empty hotels are there. So he spoke with the owners of the hotels, says he'll pay for the upkeep, the electricity, the water, give them some profit. And that's what happens. These hotels serve kosher food. Since it's a Jewish organization, they have Shabbat programs. And you have all these non-Jewish Ukrainians who are learning about Jewish culture, learning about Jewish foods. They are in Uman anyway, so they visit the grave of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. They visit the old Jewish cemetery. It's really been a very interesting and from my perspective, uplifting story to hear about how all these non-Jewish refugees are being sheltered by the Jewish community and are having very positive interactions with the Jewish community and with the Jewish volunteers and staff there. But this seems like it's coming to an end because these pilgrims are on their way. There's going to be, it seems, several thousand that will arrive, and they're going to have to stay in these hotels. I spoke to the mayor. I spoke to Rabbi Mederi, and both of them said, we really don't have a solution right now. We're looking for some other building, but we do not have access to these hotels over Rosh Hashanah. The refugees might just have to fend for themselves, or the mayor and the rabbi will find some other option. But right now, as things are shaping up, these refugees who have been in these kosher hotels and have been sheltered by the Jewish community are going to have to leave to make way for the annual Rosh Hashanah pilgrimage.
Oh my, how messy. I guess they have 6 or 7 weeks to work it out. Now, a break. When we return, more from Laser in Kharkiv.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent, and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic, because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Daily Briefing listeners. I'm so happy you've joined us for our daily analysis of what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. Like what you hear? Check out our Times Will Tell weekly podcast. Every Friday, you can hear conversations with authors, artists, archaeologists, and thought leaders from around the globe. Subscribe to Times Will Tell, our weekly half-hour feature, wherever you find your podcasts. Enjoy!
We are back. Laser, we spotted a picture of you on social media in what looked like a bulletproof vest with press emblazoned across it and a flak helmet or the equivalent. It seems like things are a little hepped up over there in Kharkiv.
That's right, Anne. I got into Kharkiv last night about an hour before dark, and from the second I drove into the outskirts of the town, I could tell that this is a city at war. It is fundamentally different than a place like Kyiv, than a place like Lviv, even a place like Odessa. This is about 20 kilometers from the Russian lines. That means it's in the range of Russian artillery. It's certainly in the range of Russian missiles and rockets. And you can see what those have done to the city everywhere you turn. You can see windows blasted out. You could see apartment buildings that have been hit. And earlier today, I went with an aid organization to some of the northernmost suburbs, to some of the easternmost suburbs, and just driving down the streets there, you can see apartment tower after apartment tower hit. You can see evidence of fire. You can see walls, floors that have collapsed. There are people living in some of these apartments still after missile strikes. No windows, no electricity, no running water, but they really have nowhere to go. Much of the city has emptied out, and the ones that are left are either people that are here for ideological reasons, they have family that can't move, or they're simply poor and they don't have the means to leave. So the aid organizations are really working overtime to try to keep these people fed, to give them medicine, have them taken care of. Now, luckily, right now, the weather is wonderful. If the situation continues when the weather starts getting colder, I think there's going to be a serious even more serious humanitarian situation on our hands. Now, it's not only those suburbs that are closest to the Russian lines that are blasted out. Even in the center of Kharkiv, when you look at some of the government buildings, the city hall building, absolutely shattered. It's going to have to be taken down. Other beautiful buildings in the center of the town, clearly they were the targets of intentional Russian strikes. There's also some Jewish communal buildings that have been hit. I do not think in any way that those are the targets of Russian strikes, but there was Russian cluster bombs or other projectiles that landed and that detonated in civilian neighborhoods, and they were close enough to damage windows and walls in the Jewish kindergarten, in the yeshiva in town. So even some of the Jewish structures have been hit as well. So this is certainly a different ballgame than what I've been doing so far. And I'm speaking to you right now after I spent some time in the hotel shelter. There was 4 explosions close enough to rattle the windows, and one of them I really actually could feel on my body. So it wasn't incredibly close, but close enough to really get a sense of how powerful the missile was. Local Telegram channels are saying that there were missiles, there were not artillery, so it's something even more powerful than what is hitting the city every day. So that is the situation here, and I will keep you updated on what I see and what I hear from Kharkiv.
Thank you, Laser. Wishing you safe travels, and we'll catch you again next week. Turning to you, Manny, how is it that Hamas is setting up weapons stockpiles and the like next to schools and mosques and hospitals?
Hi, so the army yesterday held a briefing, not to me and not to Israeli reporters, but to international media. And the point of this briefing was to show these numerous Hamas sites, such as weapon manufacturing sites and storage sites and tunnels that are all situated in and around civilian infrastructure. One of the examples is a tunnel that runs next to a Pepsi factory in Gaza City and a UN-funded school. And all of this is to preemptively kind of display Hamas as this perpetrator of war crimes, that it's, you know, situating all of its military assets in the Gaza Strip next to civilian infrastructure. Because the army has realized after the previous war that it has a very difficult time explaining each and every action it takes in real time during a war. One of the best examples was the strike on the Al Jala Tower in May last year, where the army at the didn't say at the time what was in the building that needed for them to strike it. Only months later, managed to explain it. And that building also housed international media outlets, just Al Jazeera and the Associated Press. And that caused Israel a lot of scrutiny because it was striking a building used by the media and then wouldn't really explain or elaborate on why it was attacking the building. So in preparation for the next potential war, the army is attempting to display all of these sites, including the one next to the Pepsi factory. There was an arms manufacturing and storage site next to the Shifa Hospital in the Gaza Strip, just across the road from the hospital. And this is to basically show ahead of time so that the army doesn't need to have to manage each and every strike and have to explain each and every strike, you know, why it struck this specific location, because of the difficulty in doing it in real time. It's hard to say if this will be effective or not, but the IDF Southern Command has plans to kind of throughout the year update foreign media outlets on what Hamas is up to and kind of give them this more of like a background on Hamas's activities, because they realize that when the wars in the Gaza Strip were being covered, that there was a lot of kind of missing information that the IDF was not giving to foreign media outlets, and it was giving Israeli media outlets.
Is there a time frame here? Meaning, how long in advance are they doing this kind of preemptive PR? Is it simply to pave the road for whenever something's going to happen? Or is there an actual expectation of Hamas gearing up in a new way?
So for now, at least according to the officials in the IDF Southern Command, they said that the timing of this briefing was of no major significance because they have plans to kind of do this throughout the year. And they stressed that, you know, any time is a good time to begin this kind of effort to justify potential strikes in Gaza. For now, there is no real indication that Hamas is itching for a new round of fighting. We saw airstrikes a couple weeks ago when rockets were launched at southern Israel, and Israel responded with striking several Hamas sites, but it didn't escalate further from there. And right now, things are believed to be relatively stable, and really just this effort will be, at least they hope to do this throughout the year and, you know, constantly reveal these Hamas sites and let the media know to kind of paint this picture, at least according to officials, as Hamas is this like big war criminal that, you know, conducts their military activities from civilian areas in hopes that when eventually a war or an escalation will come with the Gaza Strip, which is relatively inevitable, though it's not clear when, that at that point, when international media is covering it, they'll have all this background on what's going on.
And has Hamas responded at all?
Yes, there was a spokesperson for Hamas who posted a statement. He basically said it's all nonsense and not true, and that they don't operate from civilian areas. But we know that's not true, because round after round in the four major wars and the numerous shorter rounds of fighting in the Gaza Strip, that Hamas and other terror groups launched rockets from civilian areas. It's not something that they even hide during a war. But for now, they're saying that it's nonsense and they don't have these assets in these civilian areas. The IDF's evidence for this is difficult because it's mostly just illustrative images, them showing where a tunnel would be or where a weapons manufacturing site will be. And it remains to be seen, you know, during a war itself, whether or not the claims from the army are actually true. Although I'm more inclined to believe the army than Hamas in this case.
Well, stay tuned on that. I'm hoping that it's all theoretical and there's no future hostilities. That's it for today's Daily Briefing. Thank you, Manny. Thank you, Carrie. Until next time.
Thanks, Anne.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time,
Shalom.